Amen.
Amen. Thanks, Mackenzie. Thanks, Donna. Well, hi, everyone. I'm Janet B. from North Carolina. I've recovered from compulsive eating and bulimia. And today I want to talk about God's search and rescue mission for Dr. Bob. So, right, our big book tells us that we are all allowed to have our own concept of God. So here's mine. God created the world in 6 days, took a day off to rest, and then instead of spending the rest of eternity watching Netflix, like I might have done, he spends his time launching search and rescue missions for addicts like us. So here's the story of one of God's most successful search and rescue missions, the story of Dr. Bob, one of the two co-founders of Alcoholics Anonymous, the other one being Bill Wilson. So Dr. Bob's story comes right after the chapter, A Vision for You in the Big Book. So if you have your big book, we are on page 171. And before we talk about how God rescued Dr. Bob, let's get a little background on him. So he starts out by saying, I was born in a small New England village of about 7,000 souls. And he goes on to say, everything was fine. The town was fine. His parents were fine. They were moral, good. He had this great childhood. So his parents were great, but he became an addict anyway. And I think that's really important because a lot of us say, well, the reason I'm a compulsive eater is because dot, dot, dot. And the dot, dot, dot is usually who we blame, and it's usually our parents. But in the story in the big book, Freedom from Bondage, page 544, the author says that she didn't become an alcoholic because of what happened to her in her childhood, but she says, quote, I am the result of the way I reacted to what happened to me as a child, end quote. So again, it's always on us. Are we going to forgive or are we going to blame? Because ultimately, the fact that I am a compulsive eater has nothing to do with how I was raised. It has to do with the way I live my life. And Dr. Bob makes that clear. Continuing on page 172, he says, I was the only child, which perhaps engendered the selfishness which played an important part in bringing on my alcoholism. Now, of course, if that were true, then, only people who were only children would be addicts. And we know that's not true, right? I mean, I have a sister and I became a compulsive eater. I'm sure there are people here who are only children and people here who came from big families. It doesn't matter. But what Dr. Bob is really saying is that it's not the only child part, it's the selfishness part. And later on, he really digs in and defines it. He says, my whole life seemed to be centered around doing what I wanted to do without regard for the rights, wishes, or privileges of anyone else, a state of mind which became more and more predominant as the years passed. Well, that's interesting, right? We always talk about this illness as being progressive, but we usually think of it in terms of food, right? Our binges get worse and worse. But he's talking about, even aside from the binging, his selfishness and self-centeredness got worse. Well, that makes sense. Page 62 of our text says, selfishness and self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our troubles. So Dr. Bob was like, right on the money by saying selfishness and self-centeredness is the root. In my big book, I actually drew a little picture of a tree and I drew roots under the tree and I wrote the word selfish and self-centered by the roots. But the thing about roots is you usually don't see them, right? So we can be very good at hiding our selfishness and self-centeredness. But on a tree, you see the fruit. So I drew three little circles like apples. And in one, I wrote a big R for resentment. In one, I wrote an F for fear. And in the last one, I wrote an H for harms. Those are the fruits of our illness: resentments, fear, and harms to others. So here's Dr. Bob saying he was selfish and self-centered. And you can even see it by the example he gave. He said, my parents made me go to church, and basically, I'll show them. I decided when I was old enough, I would never go to church. Interesting. He turns his back on God, right? But he makes an exception. He says, I'll go if circumstances make it unwise to be absent. So basically, he was using church Like, I'll go to church if so and so will be mad at me if I don't go, or if it'll look good for me and help me get a good job. He used God, he used church in a self-centered, self-serving way. So it made me think something that I should ask myself, something that we should ask ourselves. Do we use our religion? Do we use God? Do we ignore God except for when we want to treat him like a genie in the bottle? Like, God, things aren't working out too well. So please come out of your bottle, make everything good again. And if you do, thanks. And I'll call you when I need you again. And if you don't, well, then I'll just ignore you even more. Never worked for me. And it didn't work for Dr. Bob. So Dr. Bob continues talking about the progression of his selfishness. And he says, through college, through medical school, he was drinking. And something I noticed when I was preparing this talk, I never really thought about page 174. It says that when he was in college, his father made the long journey out to him in the vain endeavor to get him straightened out, but it had little effect. So Dr. Bob had a dad who really loved him and who may have died before Dr. Bob even got sober, but he loved him and Dr. Bob felt it. He mentions his dad's attempt to help him more than once in his story. And so that made me think of times we might do things for people out of love and never see the results. And that's okay. Right? Imagine if Dr. Bob's dad had said, you know, I'm not going to try to help my son again. I'm not seeing any results here. You know, he didn't appreciate it. None of us would be here. But he still tried. And what that teaches me is that I should love, even when it's difficult. And even when I don't see fruit. So Bob gets his degree and he becomes Dr. Bob, right? Every mother's dream, bottom of page 174. But he says, by this time, I was beginning to pay very dearly physically. And in hope of relief, I voluntarily incarcerated myself at least a dozen times in one of the local sanitariums. Okay, this is a guy who wanted to get better. Imagine six times he committed himself, and he's a doctor, so people knew him. But he said, I need to be locked up because I just can't stop this. So he had a desire to stop, but desire alone doesn't do it, right? On page 24 of our big book, it says, at a certain point in the drinking of every abnormal drinker, he passes into a state where the most powerful desire to stop is of absolutely no avail. See, Dr. Bob had a desperate desire to stop, just like I did, but he didn't have the power, just like I didn't. When the obsession struck, he did what any good addict would do. He got his friends to smuggle alcohol into him, or he'd steal the alcohol in the hospital. So he got worse. He's in rehab and he's getting worse. And that was me, guys, my first 7 years in OA. I went to meetings. I had about 50 different sponsors. I did the work they told me, but I got worse. I went from binging and purging twice a week to throwing up six times a day and needing major surgery on my esophagus. Like Dr. Bob, I had the desire. I did a bunch of work, but I was like someone with diabetes who just went to Diabetics Anonymous meetings without ever being taught how to inject insulin. I got worse, and so did Dr. Bob. I mean, if we want to get our binge foods, we are going to get it. Or I guess the better way to say it, when the illness demands that we're going to get it, we'll get it. I once heard a woman say that she, like Dr. Bob, locked herself up in rehab for compulsive eating, and then she sent herself a candy gram. Unless we are safe and protected by God, we have no choice when it comes to food. That is the solution, to be safe and protected by God, which is comes as a result of working these steps. But here's Dr. Bob not getting better. And again, his dad's trying to help him. His dad actually doesn't just go himself, he sends a doctor from his hometown out to help him. And he's okay for a bit, but then prohibition starts. That means alcohol is illegal in the whole country. So he says, I'll get drunk now. Because in a month, when prohibition starts, then I won't be able to drink. But of course, there were bootleggers who sold illegal alcohol, and he was able to get it anyway. But it reminds me of what I had been guilty of so many times, and that's the I'll start tomorrow syndrome, right? So here's Dr. Bob. I'll start when prohibition starts. Or for me, it was I'll start tomorrow or Monday or the first of the month or the first of the year. I'll start tomorrow. What that really is me thinking my cure is my magic pillow. 7 hours with my head on it, and I'm suddenly going to be cured, right? That would really be a true magic pillow. But it didn't work for Dr. Bob, and it didn't work for me. So here he is. He goes on like this, drinking, passing out at home, going to work just so he could be at the hospital long enough to keep his job and earn money to drink. He kept this up for 17 years. 17 years. And he said during this time, he used to promise his wife, his friends, his kids that he would drink no more. And he says, these were promises which seldom kept me sober, even through the day, though I was very sincere when I made them. Again, he was sincere. He had a desire, but a desire alone doesn't do it, right? Imagine someone who has cancer going to their wife, their friends, their children, and saying, I promise you, I'll make my cancer cells stop multiplying. It would be heartbreaking, right? Because we would know that that person had zero power to make his own cancer cells stop multiplying. And Dr. Bob had zero power to make himself stop drinking. And I had zero power to make myself stop binging. So he went on like this in page 178. He talks about a group of people he found, and he says, they attracted me because of their seeming poise, health, and happiness. So this was the Oxford group. This was a Christian spiritual group that just helped people with different problems. And so he was attracted by their poise, a self-confidence, but not based on pride. It's based on confidence that God's got my back, that God's taking care of me, and I can be comfortable in any situation. So that's what these people had. And he said they had great freedom from embarrassment. They were at ease on all occasions. They appeared healthy, but most of all, they seemed happy. So again, that's a trait that we should have in recovery. That people can look at us and not say, oh my gosh, I know she's in recovery, but she looks so sad. All this work she's doing to help others and stay abstinent, it's dragging her down. She has no time to even like wash her hair. We're supposed to exude happiness, joy, and freedom. That's a promise. That's a natural result of doing this program. So, Dr. Bob, he's no dummy. He looks at himself, he sees he's ill at ease, his health was at the breaking point. And he is thoroughly miserable. So he says, I sensed they had something I didn't have from which I might profit. And I learned it was something of a spiritual nature, which didn't appeal to me very much. So he was honest. It's like, okay, I see they're happy, healthy, poised, and it's the result of some spiritual work. And yeah, I don't like it. But he said, nah, I thought it could do no harm. So I gave the matter time and study for 2.5 years, but still got drunk every night. Well, isn't that a lot of us, right? I mean, I remember reading program literature while I was binging. It was like if I had cancer and I'm reading a manual on how chemo works, but I'm not injecting the chemo, I'm not going to get better. And that was Dr. Bob, and that was me reading, from going to meetings, hanging out with people in recovery, but not getting better. And in a beautiful testimony to his wife, he says on page 178, how my wife kept her faith and courage during all those years, I'll never know, but she did. If she had not, I know I would have been dead a long time ago. His wife had courage, and she had faith. And the word courage, it always makes me think of the Wizard of Oz, right? And that cowardly lion. And what did that lion do? He continued on to Oz, even though he had fear. But he had friends who propped him up when things got difficult. So, in recovery, when it's hard, when we need courage, when we need to keep going, even when it's scary, hopefully we have friends to help prop us up along that yellow brick road. Dr. Bob always says his wife's faith kept him alive. Well, how come? How could someone's faith keep someone alive? Because faith actually does something in the spiritual world. Faith is the currency in the spiritual world. It leads us to communicate with God. And maybe it was her faith, her whispered prayers that led God to say, "My next search and rescue mission will be for her husband." Or maybe it was because at that point, Dr. Bob said at one of the Oxford groups held at the home of Henrietta Seiberling, we'll remember that name, it'll come up again. She was on God's search and rescue team for sure. At Henrietta's home, Dr. Bob said, "Guys, I have this confession to make." You could just hear everyone waiting. And he says, "I'm an alcoholic." And you can just see them chuckling behind their hands like, "Okay, Bob, tell us something we don't already know." Of course they knew he was an alcoholic. And Henrietta said, "We'll pray for you." And there they were praying for him. So their faith coupled with the faith of Dr. Bob's wife. And what was the result? Let's flip back a few pages and we'll see the results of all that prayer and faith. In the chapter of Vision for You, page 155, we find our other co-founder, Bill Wilson. Bill didn't live anywhere near Dr. Bob, but he just happened to be there on this trip. He was there newly sober. His business deal had gone down the tubes. He was not in good health. He had no money. He was physically weak. And he said, "I better do something." And so he went to a payphone. Those of you who are like my age, remember what payphones are. These are these phones. And you put in a dime or a quarter and you dialed numbers and you talked to someone. So he went to a payphone and there was a list of half a dozen churches. And he said, "I need to somehow find like a priest, minister, rabbi, someone who's going to help me find a drunk to help, because that's what I need to do." And he called all six. And not until the very last person did he get a pastor who said, "I'll get you in touch with this woman who has a spiritual group at her house. Maybe she knows someone." So Bill Wilson calls Henrietta. And when she answers the phone, he says, "My name is Bill. I'm in town for business. I'm newly sober. Do you know a drunk who I can help?" And she simply said, "We've been expecting you. We've been expecting you." She knew that her prayers were going to work. So it wasn't like, "Oh my gosh, I can't believe God answered my prayers." It was like, yeah, we prayed for help for Bob. We didn't know how it would come, but we knew it would come. Because God isn't limited by how we think things will happen. She might have thought he was going to get sober in the Oxford group, but she said, "We've been expecting you." And so then what happened? She invited Bill over and she called Dr. Bob's wife and said, "Can you bring him over here tomorrow to talk to this guy?" And Dr. Bob said, "Fine, but I'm not going for more than 15 minutes. So I actually did a little research in the book, Alcoholics Anonymous, Comes of Age, about that first meeting, how Bill really prepped for that meeting with Bob. He talked to Dr. Silkworth, the one who wrote the doctor's opinion, before he left Akron, because he was trying to help people and they weren't getting better. So they were talking strategy. And Dr. Silkworth says, "Tell him about you. Tell him about how you couldn't drink." Basically, the first thing you have to do to help someone is to help them to see that they are powerless. And maybe that's why for me, going to a therapist never worked, or going the religious route never helped me stop binging. Because what Dr. Silkworth told him is basically, you need to take a first step. You need to first admit you're powerless and your life is a train wreck, ego deflation at great depth. And that's what has to be done. So Bill went in there. And instead of getting all spiritual and telling him how great the Oxford group was, he shared stories about how he used to drink and how he would say, "I'm just going to have one." But he kept drinking until he pretty much lost everything. And so he's telling Bob this. And I'm sure Dr. Bob was saying things like, "Yeah, I drink like that too. I did that too." So he ended up saying only 15 minutes and he ended up there over 6 hours. So here's something else about Bill. He was willing to put in the time. And Dr. Bob was willing to do the work, but not willing enough. On page 155, it says, he says, "A spiritual experience was absolutely necessary, but the price seemed high upon the basis suggested. Why, he argued, should he foolishly admit his problem to his clients, right? His patients. He would do anything, he said, but that. And as we'll see, his but that would get him into trouble. Bill stayed with Dr. Bob for 3 weeks and kept working with him. Dr. Bob stopped drinking, and then after 3 weeks, he went to a medical conference and he got drunk again. And I find it fascinating what happened. Dr. Bob gets drunk. He gets drunk on the way home and he wakes up drunk at a friend's house, not even knowing how he got there. The friend called his wife and his wife called Bill. And what did Bill do? Did he say, I spent 3 weeks of my life working with you so that you would get better? How could you do this to me? Or I told you that you shouldn't go away with so little time under your belt. I'm on the next train back to New York. Goodbye and good luck. He didn't do that. Here's what Dr. Bob said Bill did. He said, he came and got me home and to bed. Okay, imagine that, right? He took him home, he put him to bed. Think about putting a drunk alcoholic to bed. Bob probably smelled. Bill probably took the shoes off his dirty feet and covered him with a blanket. And Bill stayed with him. And there's an interesting line on page 180. It says, he stayed with him and then he gave him one glass of beer the next day. And so I'm thinking, why on earth did he give him a glass of beer the next day? We don't hand people candy bars. So here's the reason. I did some research. Dr. Bob was scheduled to do a surgery that only he could do a couple days after he got back from this trip gone bad. And he was shaking so badly that Bill gave him one glass of beer just to steady his hand so he could perform the surgery. So again, that is not to say that if someone goes out, we're supposed to give them one Milky Way the next day. It doesn't work like that. This was for a very specific person for a very specific reason, so his hand wouldn't shake. And he did the surgery, which by the way was successful. And by the way, Dr. Bob never drank again because right after that surgery, he went around the town and he told all the people he didn't want to tell that he was an alcoholic. So his I'll do anything but that became I'll do anything, period. And we know that's critical, right? Page 58 tells us who can have a sponsor. It says, if you have decided you want what we have, what do we have? A spiritual experience as the result of these steps, and are willing to go to any length to get it, then and only then are you ready to take certain steps. So Dr. Bob became willing and he never drank again. And he spends the last couple of pages in his story talking about his recovery and giving us lots of good advice. He says, okay, you may be asking, what did that man, Bill, do or say that was different from what others had said or done? Because, you know, we can assume he's read the Bible, he's read a bunch of spiritual literature, he's been around spiritual people, he's a doctor. First, he says, Bill gave him correct information. And I would couple that with love. Dr. Bob wasn't a project to Bill. He loved him. There's love if you're going to take a drunk man home and take his shoes off and put him to bed and stay with him. So, love and good information. And Dr. Bob says, of far more importance was the fact that he was the first living human with whom I had ever talked who knew what he was talking about in regard to alcoholism from actual experience. In other words, he talked my language. And that comports with what's said in the foreword to the third edition. Recovery begins when one alcoholic talks with another alcoholic, sharing experience, strength, and hope. But why? Why don't they say recovery begins when I take a first step or a second step? I think it's because when one addict talks to another, something happens. There's more than a conveying of information, there's a transmission. Bill Wilson was transmitting something to Dr. Bob. I looked at the definition of transmission. It says that something like heat, light, sound, electricity, or other energy passes through a medium, kind of like telephones transmitting sound waves. And I think that in God's search and rescue for Dr. Bob, God used Bill Wilson to transmit his own love and concern for Bob. And if we go back to page 164, the end of that chapter, A Vision for You, It talks about this kind of transmission. It says you cannot transmit something you haven't got. So see to it that your relationship with him, with God, is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. See to it that your relationship with God is right. That's the condition. But what does that mean? Well, remember when Bill Wilson first got sober and was in the hospital, he said, "The thought came to me that there were thousands of hopeless alcoholics who might be glad to have what had been so freely given me. Perhaps I could help some of them. They, in turn, could help others." But before Bill could be fit for this work, he had to see to it that his own relationship with God was right. How did he do it? How do we all do it? Right? Page 164 tells us, abandon yourself to God as you understand him. That means we basically give God a blank check with our lives. Admit your faults to him. Okay, that's a little hard. And to your fellows. Well, that's a lot harder, right? Then it says, clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. And when we do that, we recover. Bill did that. He made those calls, six calls. He didn't just make two and say, yeah, I've made my calls, I give up. Then he went to this strange woman's house. And even before he went, he called Dr. Silkworth to brainstorm on the best way to help some guy he's never met. And then he spends over 6 hours with him that day. He stays in that town for 3 weeks to help him. And then when he finally thinks he's helped the guy, Dr. Bob breaks his heart by coming home drunk. But he kept at it with Dr. Bob. And thank God, because if he hadn't, none of us would be here today. You know, and every now and then someone will say something bad about Bill Wilson, like, oh, he did this thing or that thing that wasn't right. And what I say, first of all, I don't know what Bill did or didn't do, and it's none of my business. If I talk about it, it's just gossip. But more important, look what Bill did for me, for you, for us. I think that's what we should think about when we think of Bill Wilson. So back on page 180, Dr. Bob says, it's the most wonderful blessing to be relieved of this terrible curse with which I was afflicted. He says he regained his health, his self-respect, and his home life is ideal. And then he says he spends a great deal of time passing this on to others who want and need it badly. And he says he does it for four reasons: a sense of duty, it's a pleasure, because in doing so, he's paying his debt to the person who carried the message to him, and as an insurance policy against drinking again. First, it's a duty, because the truth is, I'll admit it, sometimes I don't want to pick up the phone. I don't want to go through the book with someone. I don't want to take the time. God hasn't 100% finished with me, and I'm still selfish sometimes. So some days, yes, I do it out of duty, but sometimes, and more often as time goes by, it's for the second reason. It is a pleasure. One of the great things about growing spiritually is what happens is that the more we have to do and what we want to do get closer together. The more we grow spiritually, the more what we have to do and what we want to do grow closer together. And his third reason, because in doing so, I'm paying my debt to the man who took time to pass it on to me. That's gratitude in action. And I have to tell you, when I hear my sponsee sponsoring someone or speaking at a meeting about how God has removed their food obsession, it truly makes my heart light up with joy. And last, he says, every time I do it, I take out a little more insurance for myself against a possible slip. It's our best insurance policy, right? Chapter 7, the first line says, nothing will so much ensure immunity against alcoholism or compulsive eating as intensive work with other alcoholics or compulsive eaters. Intensive work. Dr. Bob continues by saying he used to get upset when he saw his friends drink, but realized he couldn't. So he schooled himself to believe that though he once had the same privilege, he'd abused it so frightfully, it was withdrawn. So we can do that. We can say to ourselves, self, I used to have the privilege to be able to do whatever I wanted to, but I abused that privilege and now I can't. Just like if you get in too many car accidents or too many tickets, your privilege to have a driver's license is revoked. So then Dr. Bob starts talking some tough love. He says, if you think you're an atheist, an agnostic, a skeptic, or have any other form of intellectual pride which keeps you from accepting what's in this book, I feel sorry for you. It's interesting. He calls atheism, agnosticism, and skepticism forms of intellectual pride, because that's really me thinking I can do it on my own. And notice he doesn't say, if you're an atheist, agnostic, a skeptic. He says, if you think you're an atheist, agnostic, a skeptic, meaning you may think you are, but you're really not. And I guess it would be like me thinking that, like, I have no lungs. I mean, I could think it, right? This is America. I'm free to think whatever I want. So I could say, I'm a lung atheist. I don't have lungs. I don't believe I have lungs. But of course, what I think about my lack of lungs doesn't matter. And our big book tells us on page 55 that deep down in every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God. So between those two lungs that God gave me, God planted the fundamental idea of himself. And the big book says this fundamental idea of God inside of us may be obscured, but it's there. And we could talk about this for hours, but if you're interested, I did a couple podcasts on the chapter We Agnostic, really digging into that. But for now, just suffice it to say, Dr. Bob basically says, you may think you're an agnostic, but you're not. And it's almost like an invitation, right? Not like putting us down, not a challenge, but an invitation. Don't have so much pride that you block yourself off from the sunlight of the spirit. But Dr. Bob continues on with some more tough love. If you think you're strong enough to do this your way, that's your affair. Like, we're not going to try to convince you that you really need this. But if you really want to quit for good and all, not just to look good at the high school reunion so that boy who dumped you when you were 17 feels bad, says, if you want to quit for good and all and feel you need help, he says, we know we have an answer for you. And then here's his conditional promise. It never fails, but here's the condition we have to meet. It never fails if you go about it with one half the zeal you've been in the habit of showing when you're getting another drink. I put a lot of zeal into getting my binge foods. I stole food. I stole money for food. I walked the streets of New York City at 2 in the morning, spending my rent money on food. Today, I have to put that kind of zeal into my recovery. If we do this work, we are promised, he promises, it will never fail. And on the last line, Dr. Bob tells us why it won't fail. Because our Heavenly Father will never let us down. God will never let us down. Guys, I believe we're all here because God has launched a search and rescue mission for every single one of us. And he's given us a manual, the big book, and people to help us so that we can recover and then join him on his search and rescue missions for others, the way that Bill joined and rescued Bob. To me, this is such a glorious sense of purpose for all of us and a glorious God to give that to people like me, like us. And with that, I pass. Thank you.